From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The University of Utah is gearing up for Ben Shapiro's speech tomorrow night. Shapiro is a conservative writer and pundit who provokes the political left and mocks the idea of college campuses needing safe spaces and trigger warnings. Some say his comments about immigration and transgender people amount to hate speech. Last week, a group of about 50 students staged a sit-in outside the office of University of Utah President David Pershing. They were trying to get the event canceled. The administration didn't go that far, but did send officials to Berkeley recently to see how they handled the uproar there. Today in the program, Ben Shapiro is joining us to talk about his ideas on free speech and how he sees liberals as bullies who have managed to win the culture war. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. University of Utah administrators are going to allow Ben Shapiro to speak on the campus tomorrow night, even though there's been an uproar. A group of students staged a sit-in about a week and a half ago in the office of University President David Pershing. They were trying to get the event called off. Pershing has said he doesn't like hateful or hurtful language any more than anyone else, but university campuses are places for free expression. Shapiro is just one of a number of conservative commentators that has provoked protests and violence at campuses around the country, raising questions about the limits of free speech and the tolerance of college students to be exposed to ideas that offend them. Shapiro says he just wants to share his ideas about conservatism, but he knows there's an element of political theater in these gigs. He often brings a diaper to his speeches, says it's for self-indulgent children who can't handle an opposing point of view. Today in the program, we're talking with Ben Shapiro about some of the ideas he discusses in his speeches to college students and how he believes this effort to silence conservatives like him is full-scale fascism. Ben Shapiro is editor-in-chief of The Daily Wire. It's a conservative news and opinion website. He also hosts his own podcast. He's a nationally syndicated columnist and the former senior editor-at-large of Breitbart News. He's the author of a number of books, including Bullies, How the Left's Culture of Fear and Intimidation Silences Americans. He joined us from a studio in Los Angeles, where we began with the place where Shapiro's political ideas took root, at home.
My parents really didn't talk much about money at home. So we grew up sort of, I would say, at the beginning, very middle class. We lived in a house where I shared a room with three sisters. It was a two-bedroom house, maybe 1,100 square feet, 1,200 square feet, one bathroom for six people. So, that was so it's not like I grew up in sort of the lap of luxury and therefore I was seeking to protect my own economic interests. It was more like I saw my mom work really hard. I saw my dad work really hard. I didn't like the idea that the government should be taking that much of their money. And I saw that living in a religious community means that you're also sending your kids to private school, which means that you're spending an awful lot of money that you're not if you're sending your kid to public school. So this means that, from that perspective, the more the government leaves you, the better you're going to be able to take care of your family.
I want to ask you about when you first met Andrew Breitbart.
Sure.
You write about this. I think you were 17 at the time.
Yes.
At UCLA, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Writing for the newspaper there. And he noticed you. He noticed something that you had written. Would you talk a little bit about that meeting? Because I think I want to get at your relationship with him and what you may have learned about him in terms of your thinking politically.
Andrew is a wonderful fellow. And Andrew saw that I'd written a conservative piece in the UCLA Daily Bruin. Well, the Daily Bruin was not exactly known for being a right-wing bastion. And so when he saw that I'd written a very conservative piece for the Daily Bruin, he emailed me out of the blue and said, I'm a guy named Andrew. I work with Matt Drudge. Would you want to grab lunch sometime? That's kind of cool. So I emailed him back. We ended up grabbing lunch at like a greasy taco joint in Westwood, or more accurately, I ended up watching him eat lunch because I keep kosher. As he scarfed down tacos, we ended up just kind of talking politics. And what people don't understand about Andrew is that Andrew was largely motivated not by political concerns as much as cultural ones. So what he saw was a culture of bullying that existed in the university system, in the media, in politics more generally, in which there was a group of people who felt the necessity to cram down their viewpoint on other people by using tactics that he found disreputable.
Yeah.
And that's really what drove Andrew. So a lot of the sort of later politicization of his name, the sort of attempt to draft Breitbart.com into Trump world, for example, I don't know how Andrew would have felt about Trump. He in 2011 said that Trump wasn't a conservative. Maybe he would have liked the fact that Trump hit at the media a lot. But you know, the idea that Andrew was deeply ensconced in Washington, D.C. politics was just not Andrew. That's not what Andrew was about.
Well, I wanted to ask you about a story you tell in your book about Breitbart. Has this kind of Andrew Breitbart has this epiphany. It comes when he returns from to Los Angeles from school at Tulane. And he works at this kind of, I don't know, kind of hippie place called Hal's. And I guess he fancied himself a liberal in those days. But he had this experience with one African-American man who kept calling him a racist. And this started – it seems like it started changing his thinking. Would you just tell that story?
Sure. I mean, this is the story Andrew told me and that he wrote about in Righteous Indignation. Yeah. But the basic gist of the story is that he came back. He had gone to Tulane. He was very instrumental in forcibly integrating his frat. So when he got there, there had been no black pledges to the frat, and he was very instrumental in forcing the frat to open it. I think he threatened to quit the frat unless they opened it to black admittees. And so he gets back to L.A. He's lived in L.A. his entire life. You know, he grew up in L.A. He grew up in Brentwood. So this is not somebody who grew up in a conservative household surrounded by conservatives. You know, this is not a guy from the Bible Belt. And he comes back and he starts working as like a short order takeout guy. And a delivery guy. And one of the cooks at this restaurant, Hal's, is a black guy. And the guy just is calling him a racist all the time. Everything is, you're a racist. If you disagree with me, you're a racist. If you cross me, you're a racist. No matter what you do, you're a racist. And Andrew, who had grown up in this you know, liberal milieu where racist is the worst thing you can call somebody in a place like L.A. and really across America. And he thought to himself, really? Am I a racist? Is that what's going on here? Or is that just being used as a slur in order to tar me and make me feel bad about myself, but I really haven't done anything? Maybe this is just BS. And I think that was a sort of, as he told it, that was a sort of transformative moment for him where he realized that some of these labels are being thrown around in bad faith.
Yeah.
That there are some people – not all charges of racism – Andrew never said all charges of racism aren't accurate. But he did say that the overuse of the term racism to target people who you politically oppose for political gain, that was something that he found distasteful. And he found it that juxtaposed – I would say that was an important episode for him, and I would say the Clarence Thomas episode was very important for Andrew. The feeling that he got that the left had decided to waive – its own standards with regard to sexual practice on people like Ted Kennedy and then target Clarence Thomas or defend Bill Clinton while it was targeting Clarence Thomas, and they never saw any aspect of racism in that, but then they would accuse people on the right of being racist for far less. This troubled him deeply.
How much influence did his thinking, Andrew Breitbart's, have on you, do you think?
So I would say that it was more his attitude than his thinking. So I'm a very aggressive person just by nature. Andrew was also very aggressive, which is why I think that we got along very well. Andrew was more aggressive than I was. Andrew made me look passive, which is saying a lot. And so we hit it off in the sense that he saw that I was somebody who was willing to kind of walk into fire, and he liked that about me, and he appreciated that, and I appreciated that about him. And so I would say that what I learned from him mainly was – tactics rather than ideology. Andrew was not ideological. Andrew was not he really was post-ideological. He didn't know anything about economics, really. He didn't care about it. He didn't really know anything about foreign policy other than kind of the basics.
Yeah.
This is not something that Andrew deeply worried about. What he worried about was the perversion of narrative toward a particular political point of view using what he considered to be nefarious tactics. And so he was a tactical expert. I wouldn't say that he was necessarily a strategic expert in terms of advancing particular policy goals, for example. Like Righteous Indignation has very little policy talk in it.
Yeah. I guess I'm interested in the tactics that you learned then because
One
of the things that that Breitbart, and you quote him, is he believed – well, this is what you say in your book, Bullies, that Breitbart believed the left was fundamentally trying to destroy American freedom. Did he really believe that?
Yes.
Did he?
Yes.
So take me through that, if you would.
So I think Andrew probably made the same distinction that I do. When I speak about the left, I just differentiate them from people who I consider to be liberal.
Okay.
So I never use the word liberal. I always use the word left.
Right.
And the reason is because I think that liberals want to have open conversations with people even if we disagree about tax rates. Andrew felt that there was a hard left in the country that sought to destroy its opposition by calling them racist, sexist, bigot, homophobes without evidence, by targeting them personally. By taking them out of context to destroy them, and that their goal really was they did not like they didn't like the foundational principles of the country. They didn't like they weren't fond of the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, which they felt rooted in racism and bigotry and sexism, and they wanted to replace that with something foreign to the United States, a leftism more typical of Europe, and they were willing to use any means necessary to do so. That was I think that's a short version of his take.
Right. You write in your book that I want to say you said liberalism, but maybe you said something else. You said
at the time, maybe I said liberalism.
Okay.
If I did, I apologize. It should have been leftism.
Good. Okay. Well, because that's the thing I wanted to get at, because you write in Bully, liberalism, that's how you put it then, is almost invariably based on pernicious and dangerous misinterpretation at best and outright falsehood at worst. So you're not giving any leeway, any ground, at least here, Ben, in your book, to liberalism at all. Have you changed the way you distinguish liberalism from the left, or do you mean
yes,
that?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I think that like a lot of conservatives, I used to use liberal and leftist interchangeably. And I think that as I've gone along, I think that that's probably changed. I think that not in terms of not in terms of fundamental ideology. I think that a lot of liberal thought is based on pernicious beliefs. But in terms of the tactics that the tactics the left finds acceptable are not the same tactics that liberals find acceptable. And that is a major point of differentiation.
Do you see in the same way people say there is a struggle for the soul of the Republican Party, do you see the same thing going on in, let's say, the Democratic Party between
Absolutely.
People on the left and more, I don't know if moderate's quite the right word, but liberals?
Yes. And again, I think that a lot of liberals and leftists have an ideological goal in common. But I would say that, for example, Antifa and Jonathan Chait are not on the same page. Right? Jonathan Chait's a very liberal guy. We disagree on a lot of things. But Jonathan Chait is not somebody who believes that speakers ought to be shut down or Nazis ought to be punched in the face. And that, I think, is a pretty significant point of differentiation. So in that sense, sure. I think that there are a few different wings of the Democratic Party right now. I think that we have to be more specific. I think that over time, as you get older, you try to be more specific with your language. And I think that's one area where I've tried to progress. You try to be better than you were last year.
Right.
One of the things that – so I think that there are two different areas that we can talk about in terms of differentiations within the Democratic Party. One area is the ideological, so the idea of like Bernie Sanders leftist versus Hillary Clinton leftist.
Right.
In terms of ideology, right? Bernie Sanders is overtly pro-redistribution in a way that Hillary Clinton isn't quite as much. She's not – Bernie Sanders is – sort of an emissary from Democratic Socialist Europe. Hillary Clinton considers herself more of the 1930s FDR tradition, which is not quite the same thing. There are differentiations to be made on the ideological level. And then on the tactical level, I think that there is differentiation between a couple of different groups. I think that there are intersectional there's the hardcore violent left, which is people like Antifa.
Right.
There are people who are, I would say, intersectionality oriented, people who believe that there's sort of a hierarchy of viewpoint legitimacy rooted in ethnic identity. I think that President Obama engaged in some of this, building coalitions based on group identity as opposed to individual philosophy. And then there are people like Bernie Sanders who are sort of, as I say, crossing all lines, just socialist redistributionists. So there's a lot of variety inside the Democratic Party. You're seeing that. I mean, a lot of that's breaking out into the open.
Who's shouting at you on college campuses of that group?
So I think it's shouting at me or trying to hit me. I mean, they're two different groups.
Right.
So I think, I do make that distinction, right?
Yeah,
I mean, even when I spoke at Berkeley, I said, you're outside yelling at me, go ahead. It's a free country. If you're inside yelling at me trying to shut down my speech, that's not acceptable. And if you try to use violence, that's criminal. So there are distinctions to be made there. I think that the groups that are yelling at me are the intersectional left, I would say, more than sort of the more than the economic left, the intersectional left, that feels that my viewpoint is somehow an assault on their identity. Those people are shouting at me. The people who are trying to get violent are actual communist anarchists. I don't lump in Berkeley students with Antifa. I don't lump in, you know, Black Lives Matter. I've tried to make this distinction pretty clear over the past couple of years. I really don't think that, like, every Black Lives Matter supporter is the guy who shot, you know, cops in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I try not to attribute violent radicals to the movements that they find interesting. So, you know, I can oppose BLM's agenda and still say that I don't think that they're a violent radical group, for example.
But I wonder if there isn't something of the – there isn't some kind of performance aspect of what you've learned from maybe Andrew Breitbart in part in the way you speak on campuses. I mean, taking a diaper, for example, to speeches to say it's for self-indulgent, pathetic children who can't handle anyone with an opposing point of view. You do have a few little props here and there, and I'm wondering.
Oh, every so often, sure. Welcome to the media-driven world. Yeah, so some of this I did learn from Andrew in terms of, you know, getting attention for a particular point of view isn't just expressing the point of view well. It's also hitting in the most sound biteable fashion, if that were.
Yeah.
Some sort of real phrase. But I think that, you know, when I bring a diaper to campus, I'm not saying anything I don't believe. I think that all these people who are, you know, wanting to actually shut me down, not just protest me outside, but actually want to shut me down or stand in front of the stage and prevent me from speaking, you're acting like a child. And if you're acting like a child, I have two kids under four. You know, when they don't want something, then they scream and they cry until they try to get it. And they wear diapers and so should you. I mean, like, really, grow up.
But do you regret the fact that you have to use props in some ways to get attention when what you really want to do is just go on a campus and talk about your sort of deeper philosophy about what you think is better about your cause?
Yeah, I mean, would I prefer that the world were a different place where people who do interesting things didn't get attention? Sure. I mean,
yeah.
Like, I wish the Transformers didn't make $100 million at the box office on opening weekend. You know, I wish a lot of things. But the idea that you have to be entertaining in politics in order to get attention. I mean, the president of the United States is Donald Trump. I think that tells you a fair bit.
Yeah. It's Ben Shapiro. He's an author, a columnist, a podcast host, and the editor-in-chief of the conservative news and opinion website, The Daily Wire. He's speaking at the University of Utah tomorrow evening. The event is sold out, but you can get more details about it all on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the conservative writer Ben Shapiro, who has been causing a stir at universities around the country for his provocative comments. We got in touch with him because we wanted to see what all the fuss is about. Can I have you talk about the difference you see between a liberal and a conservative? Because you do write about that in Bullies. You say that conservatives think individually while liberals think institutionally. Maybe that's a good starting point where you can make a distinction between, at least as you see it, the philosophies.
So I think the philosophy of conservatism is rooted in the foundational principles of the Declaration of Independence. So the idea that government was instituted in order to protect your individual God-given right, and those rights are inalienable. And the principles of leftism are far more reflected in the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, the idea that you have rights, but those rights are protected by the collective. And when the individual comes into conflict with the collective, then the collective has to win. And so that holds true both in terms of the political agenda that's being pursued, and it also has some ramifications for tactics. So in terms of the political agenda being pursued, the idea for conservatives is what allows me to live my life without the interference of the government. Right, the government should not be up in my business. That's basically conservatism. If you had to nutshell it, that's basically the nutshell. Leftism is about the idea of the government establishing communal equality. So using the powers of the community, motivating the powers of the community and really the government gun in order to establish the prerequisites for equality. And we as a community will define what happiness looks like for you. So we're going to define you know, that happiness looks like a certain level of economic development, for example. And so we will take money from one person and give it to another because that's fair, and we'll use the power of the community in order to achieve this. Hmm. This also has ramifications for group identity. So, as I say, there's an intersectional left that suggests that your identity as an individual is secondary to your identity as a member of a group. So if you are Clarence Thomas, you're not legitimately black. The reason you're not legitimately black is because your group identity is black, and we know that black people are predominantly on the political left. So if you're not on the political left, this means you are no longer part of the in-group. This is something conservatives reject wholesale. We don't believe that your skin color or your sexual orientation or your religion, any of this should allow me to judge you as an individual. Your group identity should be secondary. Now, this is, as I say, my vision of what conservative and liberal is. This is not you'll notice there's some pretty significant variations mm-hmm. from, you know, how Donald Trump acts, for example, which is why I did not support either Trump or Hillary in this last election cycle. So, you know, these are sort of the roots of the thing. I think when it comes to the political ramifications of that in terms of how people gain votes, this has pretty significant ramifications. The reason I make that distinction in bullies is what I say is that the left is very fond, because they see the community as the first priority. The left is very fond of using communal solutions, including government, as well as appealing to groups through institutions. So if we can grab the educational institutions and then convert people in groups, we'll be better off. Conservatives have sort of a general antipathy toward this sort of thinking. So the idea instead is, I'm not going to try and convert you by grabbing control of an entire institution. I'm going to try and convince you on a one-to-one level. I think this is why the left has been very successful at taking over most of the institutions of American life. I mean, the culture and cultural institutions have largely been dominated by the left. Even the ones that the left thinks are dominated by conservatives, like corporate life, the statistics don't really tend to bear that out particularly well.
You write that conservatives have allowed liberals to win the culture war because, as you put it, we're generally civil people.
So I think that's right. I mean, I think that if you look at the typical conservative, in my view, is somebody who is not particularly interested in politicizing every aspect of culture. Again, I do not use President Trump as a great example of this. I think that, you know, that people like me, what I would like to do at the end of the day, I want to do my work. I want to get money for my family. I want to go to synagogue on Saturdays. And I want to go home and watch TV when I want to watch TV. And I don't want to be bothered with politics when I watch TV. And when I watch a football game, I don't want to be bothered with politics. We have to have these sort of communal areas where we leave each other alone. And I don't think that because the fundamental tendency of conservatism is leave me alone, that's a very different tendency than I'm not going to leave you alone until equality is achieved, which I think is the fundamental tendency of the left. Hmm. So when it comes to culture, the right has basically abdicated. They've said, well, entertainment's not a place for politics. Entertainment's a place for entertainment. And the left has said, well, entertainment is our means of distributing our message. So why shouldn't we get involved in distributing our message through the loudest bullhorn we can find? And so the right has abdicated its duty in some of these areas, thinking that a conservative lifestyle means being left alone and not understanding that the left has no intention of leaving people alone on an institutional level or on a cultural level.
One of the things that's interesting is you, the way you write about what you see as an extremely concerted effort on the left. And in some ways, I have to say, it sounds a bit like, and I don't mean this as a put down, but you know when Hillary Clinton talked
about. Oh no, put me down. I don't care.
Okay. Well, when Hillary Clinton talked about there being a vast right wing conspiracy, it seems mm-hmm. like on some level you are saying, in fact, there is a conspiracy, but it exists on the left.
No, and, I don't think that it's Hillary. I think thinks that we all get together in our off hours and hang out together at bars, figuring out how to keep Hillary Clinton down. I don't think that's what the left does at all. I think there are institutions that are dominated by like-minded people, and it never even occurs to most of them that they are operating in the same direction. So I think that when you talk about the media infrastructure, for example, when I talk about NPR, NPR is a liberal institution. It's a left. It has a leftist ideology, and it is liberal in its political orientation. Hmm. That being the case, I don't think it's a bunch of people at NPR who are sitting around thinking, "Ooh, how do we push our leftist positions today?" I think the people who work at NPR tend to be liberal because they grew up in big cities and went to good colleges and hung out with other liberal people, and many of them have never met a conservative, and many of them have never talked with people outside of the cities they live in, which is not rare, right? Most people don't talk to a lot of people outside the cities they live in. Most people hang out in the social groups they hang out in. Yeah. This creates a bubble. And that bubble is then used to distribute the information to people who are not inside the bubble. This is the same thing I think about Hollywood. I wrote an entire book, Primetime Propaganda, with exactly this premise. Not saying that people in Hollywood get together behind closed doors and go, ooh, how can we push our evil liberal agenda today? But, you know, but more like what we're making reflects our life. And our life is a liberal life. And we have a bullhorn. And why wouldn't we make a show about the people we know? And the people we know are all liberal. And then there are a bunch of people who are consuming this information who don't live inside those bubbles. And I think that the bubbles are self-created, and I don't think they're always intentional. I think that most of the time they're not intentional, actually.
But can I push back on that a little bit, though? Because you,
sure.
You, in your book, Bullies, you say this: it all begins inside the White House and the Democratic Party, where anti-conservative strategies are hatched. The White House begins putting out its talking points via groups like the Center for American Progress, and you could go through some of these. Mm-hmm. Those groups put in phone calls and emails to their allies in the mainstream media, and you go through some of those. It does sound like you were making a case in Bullies for a fairly concerted strategy.
When it comes to pushing specific political talking points, This is still correct.
Okay.
Right, when it comes to pushing specific political talking points, like in Hollywood for many years, they had Green Week on TV. Right. During the Obama administration, they had Green Week, where it was just like every show would have a green message embedded in it. Did that happen by chance? Did all of the networks just decide that week they were going to call it Green Week and we were going to just put environmental messaging? I mean, the White House was calling people, right? I mean, the White House has power. By the way, this is not conspiracy theory. I mean, on the left, I assume they feel the same thing about the Bush administration or the Trump administration. That members of the Trump administration call Sean Hannity, and then they say to Sean, "Here's what we're doing today." Yeah. And then Sean talks about what he's doing today, and then Sean pushes it, and then there are a bunch of people who pick that up and run with it.
Right.
Like that's none of this. I mean, this is typical politics. Yeah.
You do say in the book that this isn't illegal. I mean, you find it tremendously immoral. But
I do find it tremendously immoral to use here's what I find immoral. I find immoral hiding the ball. So it's one thing I object to the idea that people present themselves as independent sources of information and are just taking talking points. That I do object to. And there are places that do this, right, on both sides. I think that on the left, when I was writing Bullies, Obama was president, so that's what I was writing about.
Right.
When on the left, the use of these methods of information dispersion without the knowledge even of the people who are consuming the information is immoral. So I once was at the RNC actually in 2012. It was the convention, and Sam Donaldson was walking around the floor. Hmm. And I went over to interview him briefly, and he at the time was hosting an opinion show on, I think it was ABC News Radio. And I asked him, you know, why is it that you're hosting an opinion show where you're very much to the left? You portrayed yourself as an objective news reporter for the vast majority of your career. Did you have the same opinions then? He said, yes. And I said, well, that seems dishonest to me. Like, if you had those opinions then and then you're portraying yourself as an objective news reporter, obviously that affected your reporting. And he said, do you think you're better than I am? I said, yes, I do think I'm better than you because I openly acknowledge what my political bias is, and then I present the information I'm presenting. So take it or leave it. You know, the thing that I object to, and this Andrew did object to as well, you know, I think that it's easy to exaggerate the impact that Andrew had on me in terms of like Andrew being my formative guy.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to start attributing life influencers, I would start with my parents.
Right.
But you know, this is stuff that's pretty commonly held across the conservative movement, is this idea that presenting people like George Stephanopoulos as an objective news reporter is laughable. I mean, the man was the chief of staff to the Clintons. It's like having Karl Rove be the objective news reporter on Fox News. Like, you can't do that. So that is hiding the ball, and that's cheating.
I want to ask you, so there's a flyer that's going around from a group called Refuse Fascism. Apparently this was a flyer in Berkeley. But I want to go through some of this stuff, and I want to get you to respond. Because obviously one of the reasons for some of these protests is what they see as, you know, the temperature of your comments. And I want to get
let me stop you there for a second, and then I'll let you go. We'll go through, I promise.
Yeah, okay.
So that's not true. So the reason for the protest is because any conservative is coming to campus. Most of these people have no idea who I am. Yeah. Right? They protested Heather McDonald. They protested Charles Murray. They protest Jason Riley. They protest anyone they think is conservative. And then they lump everyone together with people like Milo Yiannopoulos. Right? This is the goal, is to treat everybody the same on the right, as though we are all of identical viewpoint. That's patently insane.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not arrogant enough to believe that all these Antifa people are going and watching the Ben Shapiro Thug Life videos on YouTube. Like, I don't think that's what they're doing in their spare time. My guess is that the vast majority of these people have never heard of me, and they had one person whose task it was to go on Google and find the most incendiary things I had said in my 17-year career in this field, and then take those out of context, put them on a flyer, and pretend that that's the reason they're protesting.
Well, that's what I want to go through. Some of these, obviously.
We can pretend that's a legit reason, and I'm happy to talk about all the things they say, but that's not really why they're protesting me. Otherwise, they'd be protesting, you know, presumably. You know, otherwise they'd be protesting you. I mean, I assume that if we go through all the hours of radio, you've said something at some point we can take out of context and use against you.
Okay, well, let me just mention a couple.
Sure. A
tweet that you sent, I'm sure you've seen a share of these, February of 2016. Yep. Trayvon Martin would have turned 21 today if he hadn't taken a man's head and beaten it on the pavement before being shot. Now, did you write that, and do you regret it?
I wrote it. I don't regret it. The reason I don't regret it is because that was Trayvon Martin's birthday, and the entire Twitter was dominated with messages about how Trayvon Martin was an innocent who was murdered in a racist killing. And so I was pointing out in response that these are the facts that the Obama Justice Department established. Okay, not me. The Obama Justice Department and a jury of George Zimmerman's peers established this in the Florida trial. That the rationale behind the shooting was that Trayvon Martin was sitting atop George Zimmerman and pounding his head into the ground when George Zimmerman shot him. The Obama Justice Department could not bring any federal hate crimes charges. They could find no evidence of a hate crime having taken place. So, as always on Twitter, everything gets boiled down to under 140 characters. Mm-hmm. There is nothing factually incorrect about that tweet. To remove it from the context of what everyone was tweeting about that day is a little unfair.
Yeah.
But no, I don't regret tweeting something factual. I mean, I've said. I've laid out the entire history of the Trayvon Martin case in, I think it was in Bullies. I did an entire three-chapter routine on it.
Absolutely. But just in terms of what you think you're trying to accomplish on campuses, get conversations going, getting a situation where you have people on the left or have a liberal perspective to come and actually hear you out, if not agree with you, at least hear you out. And then tweeting something like that, which could be construed as really insensitive, doesn't seem to be getting there.
So, again, I would agree with you, except for the fact that it's ignoring all of the context in the milieu. If you would like to read my entire essay on what I think happened with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, you are free to go buy Bullies, and there's about 40 pages on it. If you want to try and boil down what I think the essence of the trial was, that whole thing, by the way, doesn't in that tweet, it never says that Trayvon Martin deserved to be shot. It says that Trayvon Martin, if he had not – this is a factually true statement. If he had not been sitting atop George Zimmerman pounding his head into the ground, he would not be dead today.
I know, but don't you get how that would seem a little crass to some people?
I don't understand how a factual explanation of why he was killed on the day when everyone on the internet was suggesting that he was killed due to racism – If you find the facts surrounding his death offensive, then I suppose that you find the tweet offensive. Yeah. But the facts surrounding his death don't change just because you find them offensive.
Right. You also told students in December of 2016 at Yeshiva University, transgender people are unfortunately suffering from a significant mental illness that is deeply harmful. It's not a solution to pretend that transgender people are the sex they think they are in their head. Now, I know you firmly believe this.
This is correct, yes. So, it's called gender dysphoria or gender identity disorder. Look it up in the DSM.
I guess what you're saying, I think what people are opposed to is that this is their gender identity. It sounds like what you're opposed to is the idea that they are demanding a certain kind of pronoun be applied to them. Well, one of them. Obviously, you also have a sort of biological question here, too. But just take me through your thinking on it, if you would.
Sure. You demanding that I call you a woman when you are not a biological woman is an imposition on me. You can think whatever you want about you. I don't care. Do what you want. But the minute you start suggesting that it is my obligation to call you by your preferred pronoun and that pronoun has an objective meaning in society, the answer is no. I'm happy to call Caitlyn Jenner Caitlyn. I'm not happy to call Caitlyn Jenner she, because Caitlyn Jenner is not a she. Caitlyn Jenner is a genetic and biological male.
Words
have meanings, and I like words because they have meanings. And the minute we start destroying the meanings because we're worried about sensitivity, we cannot even communicate with one another anymore.
This gets to something that you've written about. You wrote about some of the lessons that you learned, for example, about what you're seeing on campus at Berkeley in particular. I think this was the case. Mm-hmm. And you said one of the things you learned is that, quote, many students are infected by the microaggression mentality. Explain what you mean.
So the microaggression mentality is this idea that if I say something and you find it offensive, I have aggressed against you. It's not just that you're offended. I have aggressed you. And this, as Jonathan Haidt has said from New York University, he has said that this sort of mentality leads to the idea that you're allowed to aggress against me, right? A microaggression must be met with macroaggression. Aggression must be met with aggression. Mm. It must be met with bans. It must be met with actual physical harm. You know, that's silliness. If you want to say that I'm saying something insulting, you have to identify where I insulted you. But even an insult is not the same thing as a microaggression. Microaggression, again, the very word suggests aggression. I was brought up on certain truisms, one of which was that sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will never hurt you. And it seems that we have moved well beyond kindergarten sloganeering at this point. Now it's that not only do words hurt you, words are an excuse for you banning me from your campus. Even when I don't intend to harm you, and even when I say it's not an objectively offensive thing. It is not objectively offensive for me to say that a biological man should be called a biological man, any more than it is objectively offensive for me to say that you should be called a human being and not be called a chicken. Okay, words have meanings.
But you get where people would feel oppressed over time in a certain cultural time when...
If you feel oppressed by reality, that's your problem. I didn't construct it.
I guess I'm
the
just...
The reality is that you are not a woman just because you say you are a woman. If the word has any meaning at all, then that's the truth. If you want to say that you're a human male who suffers from gender dysphoria, or if you're intersex, right, which is not usually what we're talking about in these cases, or if you're hermaphroditic, which is almost never what we're talking about in these cases, then there are terms that we can apply. Words have to mean something or we can't even talk to each other.
But I guess what I'm asking is when you get to the point where you have people who feel like over time they have been, I'll go back to the word oppressed, certainly, or persecuted because of their gender identity, their sexuality, and they feel traumatized on some level. And shouting you down may not be the right response to that, but they do feel a kind of trauma, it seems. I'm wondering if you can
Okay, so I will acknowledge if you feel trauma because you have legitimately been wronged. I'm not going to acknowledge that you are traumatized by me saying something factually true.
Right.
Jews have been traumatized over time.
Yeah.
If you call me a Jew, I'm not insulted because guess what? I'm a Jew.
You quote a Brookings Institution survey not so long ago in a piece that you wrote that showed 44% of students had said that the First Amendment does not protect hate speech. What do you make of that? And more than half of these students said they were in favor of students shouting down speakers who are known for making offensive and hurtful statements. Is this distinctive? Is this unique? Is this a significant change on campus?
It seems like a significant change. I mean, I looking at the poll data, it's a significant change. That's a very high number. I mean, first of all, just legally speaking, and, you know, I am a lawyer, legally speaking, the idea that hate speech is not protected by the First Amendment is asinine. Of course it's protected by the First Amendment because there's no objective definition of hate speech. Right? The entire conversation we just had about he versus she, there's a whole group of people in the United States say that I am engaging in hate speech if I say that a man is a man and a woman is a woman. Should I be able to be prosecuted by local law enforcement and have no First Amendment protections based on that? This is the problem. Who's going to draw that line with regard to hate speech? So legally speaking, these kids don't know what the hell they're talking about. Mm. And then when it comes to the idea that they should be able to shout down speakers of whom they do not approve, all I would say is that it's very easy to say this kind of thing when you're in the majority. The whole point of the Constitution is to protect both the will of the majority and to protect the rights of the minority. Okay, I'm the ultimate minority when I speak on these campuses, and I'm the only guy in the room who I agree with, right? I mean, if you're there shouting me down, I would suggest that these people who – it's incredible. The same people who say that you know, I should be shouted down are parts of groups called Refuse Fascism. It's just incredible. The Orwellian nature of this is beyond description.
You say it's full-scale fascism.
It is full-scale fascism. I mean, the definition of fascism is that people mistake fascism for the politics in various countries that employed fascism. Fascism is a tactic. right? The term fascism originated with Mussolini in a word called the fascisti. The fascisti literally means a bundle of sticks, the idea being that the bundle is stronger than any individual stick. And so if you organize from the top and you organize people into these bundles, it's more powerful than if they were treated as individuals. That tactic expresses itself as the idea that group trampling of individual rights with the force of the government gun behind it, that this is legitimate. So governmental fascism is when the government does this. Individual, the sort of fascistic ideology that suggests that you and your friends get to shut me up, that's more ideological fascism than it is, you know, formal fascism, because mm-hmm. formal fascism is a governmental movement.
Ben Shapiro, who is speaking at the University of Utah tomorrow evening. The event is sold out, but you can get details on our website at radialwest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Ben Shapiro, who's speaking at the University of Utah tomorrow night. Are you tired of the question, how do you explain Donald Trump? Are you tired?
I mean, I kind of find it fun, honestly. I mean,
do you?
Well, I mean, you can either laugh or you can cry about the political state of the country. So one party ran a reality TV game show host, and the other party ran the most disliked major candidate in the history of American politics. So well done, everybody.
Yeah.
And then the two minor party candidates were Jill Stein, a legitimate kook, and Gary Johnson, who legitimately did an interview with his tongue hanging out of his mouth for half of it. I'm like, well, just America, well done. You know, as Churchill said, that democracy was the worst system except for all the others. And that truism has never been truer. It's what a brutal election cycle. In any case, how do I explain Donald Trump? Donald Trump is pure reactionary. Okay, Donald Trump is a pure reaction. So there are a lot of people who felt during the Obama era that they were treated in precisely the ways I talk about in Bullies, that they were called racist, sexist, bigot, homophobes, that there was no evidence behind this, that they were marginalized, and that they were treated as though they were the wrongful oppressors in the history of America. Yes, there was slavery. Yes, there was Jim Crow, but it wasn't me, right? That is how a lot of people feel. I wasn't there for this, and to blame me for the historic sins of America is not fair to me. And so when I see Barack Obama saying that the historic racism of the United States can never be wiped out of the DNA, that's something I object to. Why doesn't he look at the fact that the other thing in the DNA of the United States is a freedom that has grown over time and in which I participate each day by not discriminating against people, right? This is how a lot of people felt. This election cycle was a culture war, and the left got a punch on the chin. I mean, and that's what Trump was. Trump was not about Trump. It was not about Trump being some brilliant campaigner. He wasn't. It wasn't about Trump being a brilliant speaker. He wasn't. It was about Trump being a militant reaction to a lot of the feelings that people had about political correctness. Now, Trump was a crappy vehicle for this stuff because Trump wasn't just anti-political correctness. Trump was also pro-vulgarity, and Trump was also, you know, pro-stupidity, and Trump was – there are a lot of things about President Trump that I really dislike. Half the stuff that he said was anti-PC wasn't anti-PC. It was just him being a jackass. Mm-hmm. But that's what he was. Okay, what he was a reaction to a feeling that America had been polarized along group lines, and there was a new identity group that was going to form in opposition to that, and Trump played on that. And I think that's the simplest explanation for Trump. I did a full column for the Jewish Journal out here where I sort of said that the way I put it is there were three forces, I think, that drove Trump movement. One was this anti-establishment force. Everything sucks. Bring the guy in who doesn't know anything. At least he's not one of them.
Yeah.
There was the anti-PC force, which I just discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this anti-Obama force, right? This sort of anti-Obama force, this idea that Obama had wrecked the country and now we're going to have our revenge by electing this guy. So I think there was some of that.
So you write in Bullies that liberalism had been ascendant in America for the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the Trump election marks an end to that, or just kind of a blip?
No, I don't think it marks an end or a blip. I think it marks a mutation. I think we're going through a mutation right now. Trump is not a conservative. Yeah. And he doesn't believe in any of the foundational principles that I've talked about. He doesn't speak like a conservative. He doesn't talk like a conservative. He never talks about individual liberty or individual freedom. He talks about what I'm going to do for you as president. If you look at his rhetoric about what he's going to do, it actually looks a lot like Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. I'm here to solve your problems, right? I am your voice. He said these things during the campaign, right? I'm the only one who can fix it. Right. This is something that conservatives don't say. Right. I go on campus and what I say, my slogan is solve your own damn problems. OK, I'm not going to solve them for you. It's your job to solve your problems. It's a free country. Trump doesn't say any of that kind of stuff. Right. Trump is not a conservative. And what we're seeing instead is the identity politics that I think that Barack Obama engaged in and that the left has engaged in for many years and which I have fought against on the left. What scared me is that I saw it emerge on the right, and that I hated. Right? I mean, this is why I fought Trump. This is why I fought the white identity politics that I think took place during this election cycle. It's why the alt-right targeted me viciously during this election cycle. I was the number one target of the alt-right, according to the Anti-Defamation League online last year.
I saw that.
Right? And I'm a right-winger. So yeah. The idea that Trump reflects conservatism, I don't think that's right. I think Trump reflects the full-scale descent of a huge percentage of Americans into tribal politics. I think that's all this is. I think it's very. I actually don't think it's all that complex.
You write that Trump supporters today, many of them, they're more interested in pissing off the left than actually beating the left.
I agree. Yes, I agree with me.
You agree with you?
yes, I think that's right.
Elaborate on that.
There is an element of the right that says the left has been a nefarious force. I'm not that interested in necessarily defeating them because. We attribute – it's more about their tactics than it is even about what they're seeking to do politically. So it's not about what the left is seeking to grow government, for example. It's that the left is insulting me personally. So if I can tick them off and I control them, go for it. The fact that Trump ticked off the left was an asset to him. It was not something bad. Right? This last weekend is a perfect example of this. So the NFL controversy I think is a perfect example of this. So what Trump actually did, what he actually said is not conservative, right? He said a couple of things. One, don't kneel for the anthem. I agree with this. Don't kneel for the anthem. It's one of the few unifying symbols left in America. Kneeling for the flag, kneeling for the anthem is not appropriate. You want to protest what you see is police brutality. There's a police station right down the street. Lead a march. Yeah. But what I do not agree with is this idea that from the White House, the president of the United States should be calling on private corporations to fire people because of their political viewpoint. This is anti-conservative and dangerous. There are a lot of people on the right who are perfectly fine with it, with all of the, you're fired, kick the son of a bitch off the field, that kind of stuff.
Right.
There are a lot of people on the right who are happy about that because it made the left crazy, because the left reacted with this anger. And so the right felt like, Obama used to do this to us all the time. The right feels like the left has been doing this to us for years, calling us racist at every available opportunity. Barack Obama going around and saying things like we're bitter clingers, right, which he said in 2008. Yeah. Or going around and saying that in the aftermath of the Henry Louis Gates incident that the Cambridge police acted stupidly or that Trayvon Martin would have been his son if he had had a son. Or that the Ferguson riots, while he doesn't like rioting, he sees why the feelings are justified and there's systemic police racism. And after the shooting of cops in Dallas, that he goes there and he talks about systemic police racism at the memorial service. And there are a lot of people on the right who felt like, this guy just ticked me off. He just ticked me off. And it's like a bad marriage now, right? Your spouse ticks you off. Okay, you don't care so much about restoring a good marriage. Now, a really bad marriage, you feel like, okay, well, what can I do to piss her off? And I feel like both sides are now caught in this. I feel like the left is much more interested in ticking off Trump and ticking off the right than in accomplishing anything. And I think the right is more interested in ticking off the left than in accomplishing anything. And so we get to have stupid culture wars from here till the end of time, which is really exciting for media folks. We make bank off of it, but it isn't great for the country.
You did kind of like Trump's speech at the UN, how he ripped the UN bureaucracy, how he tore into Cuba, how he...
Yeah, that was good. The UN's terrible.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right. But then you said – so I guess what I'm asking, you say that in some way he may be off the track of being an isolationist and toward being an interventionalist and a traditional Republican, at least rhetorically. So do you see some redeeming potential in Donald Trump, at least ideologically?
So I hate to talk in terms of like redeeming qualities of anybody because I don't feel like I have to make an overall assessment of the guy. I think like as a human being, I am not a fan, as if this is not clear.
Right.
What I've done is I've done the same thing with him that I think I did with Obama, which is I try to assess their actions on an individual level. So the UN speech, good. His shtick with the NFL, stupid, right? And so when it comes time to make an overall assessment of whether I vote for him in 2020, then it'll be time to make that overall assessment. But I give him weekly grades over at Daily Wire. He's right now averaging, I think, a C minus. So not doing particularly great in my grades. He's gotten an F like two out of the last 3 weeks. So you know, I try to assess each one of these things individually. Am I happier with that UN speech than I would have been if he had come out and gone full Ron Paul? Of course. Yeah. Was I thrilled that he was calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man? No, I think it's idiotic. Like, if the whole point is to demonstrate the threat of Kim Jong-un is so serious that we need to possibly take military action against him, it seems to me that deriding him with the name of an Elton John song is silly. but the overall in that speech, I mean, I thought there were a lot of things in that speech to like. I think when he's on teleprompter, I agree with him maybe 65% of the time, 70% of the time. When he's off teleprompter, I tend to disagree with him almost 100% of the time.
Ben, let me ask you this finally. You've said one of the things you learned in Berkeley and maybe elsewhere is that students can handle it. So do you feel optimistic? I mean, on one hand, you say this is full-blown fascism trying to shout people down. On the other hand, people can handle it. Where do you think we'll end up, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, I think the people inside the auditorium can handle it. I think the people outside the auditorium shouting speech is violence. They were literally chanting that. They were literally chanting speech is violence. Okay, that's fascist talk. Speech is violence is fascist talk because now you're saying – If I use that phrase against NPR, NPR speech is violence, the next step would be, okay, I need to shut them down. They're violent, right? Call the cops. The speech is violence is fascism. When I said you can handle it, the idea was no one got hurt. You know, it was ridiculous. Ridiculous. I spoke at Berkeley a year and a half ago. You know how much security costs at Berkeley? Zero. $0. I went there. I spoke to a packed house, like 450 kids. No problem. Nothing. I go to this time, they spend $600,000. $600,000. I mean, my God, if I knew they were going to spend that kind of money, send me the check and I'll skip it. I mean, it's absurd. Right? They do all that. That's not because of me. And the way the media covered it was so crazy. It was like, Berkeley braces for Shapiro visit. Yeah. Really? Am I the one who's breaking the ATMs? I mean, you've heard me on this show. Do I sound like the kind of fellow who's going out there with a brick and clocking people? Yeah. Like, is that what I do? Or is it all the morons outside who feel like they need to not only shut me down but get violent in order to do so? So when I say you can handle it, what I mean is you are capable of handling it. That does not mean you will, right? You are capable. You have the capacity to handle it. If you don't, you are acting like a small child. And again, I'm happy to bring you diapers. But the idea that you are going to handle it is not quite the same thing as you are capable of handling it, right? I think every human being is capable of hearing an opposing point of view. The question is whether you're going to be enough of a human being to actually listen to it without wanting to hit somebody.
It's Ben Shapiro. He's going to be in Utah tomorrow evening for a speaking engagement here on the campus of the University of Utah. The event is sold out, but you can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Shapiro joined us from a studio in Southern California. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Michael Havey, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.